Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. We've got a gigantic show for you. So in just a little bit, big update on how the Democratic debates are going to play out through this primary process. Who's going to get debates, and perhaps more importantly, who is not going to be holding debates? We'll have that, and why, actually. These decisions have been made in just a little bit. We also have, at the end of the show, we're going to close out with an analysis of some of the initial demographic breakdowns of who's supporting who in this primary, which actually I think can tell us a lot about how some of these early nominating states might play out. And if we don't see certain candidates, if certain candidates that we expect might run don't, or if they do but then drop out relatively early, how might their supporters then move to other candidates? So lots of implications for how the next few years will play out at the close of the show. By the way, stick around just a little bit later on because we've got some videos from the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security talking about the administration's family separation crisis. It is devastating. Like, her legacy was written yesterday. These videos are going to be played for years, and we're going to be showing you some a little bit later on. Along the way, two awesome guests. Later on the show, Natasha Leonard of The Intercept is going to be joining us to talk about a push to decriminalize sex work in New York. And in just a little bit, Sarah Kleiner is going to answer the question, who is John Hickenlooper? I really don't know, so I'm going to learn as much as you are in all likelihood. By the way, also, this is just a personal plug for my Twitter, at John Iadarola. This is not to follow me for politics, which is 90% of the time what I'm tweeting about, but I have decided that since there's 38 days until the launch of the 8th season of Game of Thrones, which is my favorite show of all time, I am going to be binging all of it and live tweeting my rewatch of the series. So if you follow me on Twitter, at John Iadarola, and actually on Instagram, at John Iadarola, I'll be putting up some photos from throughout the series of moments that I had forgotten about. Perhaps we can talk about the series in advance of season 8. Second only in importance to Game of Thrones, the 2020 Democratic primary. So we turn to that now. It was announced yesterday that Fox News will not be hosting any of the debates in the 2020 Democratic primary, which I guess is controversial. That's what I'm hearing online. It doesn't really strike me as super controversial that a body that is so obviously not looking for the best interests of the Democratic Party or Democratic voters or people on the left more generally would not be holding one of the debates. But I guess it needed to be made clear. So the committee's chairman of the DNC, Tom Perez, said in a statement that Fox News, quote, is not in a position to host a fair and neutral debate for our candidates. He cited an article published this week by The New Yorker that reported on ties between the president and Fox News, which he deemed a, quote, inappropriate relationship. So we're going to return to some other aspects of how inappropriate the relationship is between Fox News and the Trump administration in just a little bit. But this announcement was met with condemnation from the right, not just from the right, but mostly from the right, with the managing editor of Fox News' Washington Bureau, Bill Salmon, saying, we hope the DNC will reconsider its decision to bar Chris Wallace, Brett Baer, and Martha McCollum, all of whom embody the ultimate journalistic integrity and professionalism from moderating a Democratic presidential debate. Now, look, at times, Chris Wallace and, to a lesser extent, Brett Baer and Martha McCollum they've done some stuff that's acceptable. Chris Wallace got a lot of attacks from the right for the way he questioned representatives of the administration on their immigration policy just a few weeks ago. We acknowledge that. Brett Baer did something. Nothing leaps to mind. But I remember vaguely he did some stuff that wasn't Hannity-esque, I suppose. But the issue is that you cannot just hide behind a couple of figureheads as a network. We know who you are. We see you, Fox News. And I am going to run through some of the reasons you obviously are not the right party to be holding one of these debates. But the other side of the response comes from Donald Trump, who read this news and said on Twitter, Democrats just blocked Fox News from holding a debate. Good. Then I think I'll do the same thing with the fake news networks and the radical left Democrats in the general election debates. So none of that really means anything. There's a very real chance that Donald Trump, who's a guy who tried to game the debate system the last time so much, saying he wasn't going to do any of the primary debates unless they paid him $1 million or whatever. It was all games. He might not want to do the debates this next time around because there might be very serious questions about his illegality that will come up, the criminal acts that he is engaged in, all of that. But in all likelihood, the dude loves the crowd. He's going to do it. I don't The DNC should not stop for literally 1 second to consider what Donald Trump or what Fox News thinks about the way their primary is going to play out. What they should be thinking about is, how do we choose the best candidate to both defeat Donald Trump and then do what is necessary for the country, while also reassuring people that all of the improprieties that happened during the 2016 election are not going to happen in 2020 and will not happen in future elections. That's what they should be thinking about, not what Bill Salmon or what Donald Trump think about this entire thing. Now, responding to the concerns about Chris Wallace and, oh, you know, he's great, so why not Fox News? Tom Perez was on with Chris Hayes, and here is what he had to say.
So I have great respect for Chris Wallace, and my concern is not about Chris Wallace. It's about people above Chris Wallace, because what we have seen now, and it's been really most recently now in the New Yorker story, is that at the highest levels of Fox News, they're not playing it straight. And again, this isn't about Chris Wallace. I have respect for him, but I do not have the confidence that we need to take such an important part of the nomination process, these debates, and trust them to folks who at the top levels are consulting Donald Trump before they do anything. I couldn't do that.
Okay, so Tom Perez brought up some good points there on why this isn't about Chris Wallace. This is about Fox News and their leadership and, more importantly, their mission, their philosophy, their ideology, what role they actually serve. Because although I felt like years and years ago we'd already figured out what Fox News was about and we didn't need to continually relitigate this, there is some people who still think that they are a legitimate journalistic body, that they're just a media organization. There are more people who think, well, okay, they're a media organization, but with a particular slant. Or even, well, okay, they're a partisan media organization, but they're still serious. All of those positions are false. And he brought up some good examples of why that is. So I want to run through a few. This is an informal sort of thing. I've just got some bullet points. We generated this by sitting around before the show and just talking about, hey, you remember all the BS Fox News is engaged in? So let's talk about some big ones. So just in the last election, they pushed, being driven entirely by Donald Trump's rhetoric, a fake caravan narrative to try to help Republicans before the midterm. They all pretended, all of them, that that was a serious story that we should be deciding our vote in the 2018 midterms on. Didn't actually work out for them. So we found out just a few days ago, a lot of this is very recent, by the way, found out just a few days ago that in advance of the 2016 election, they had this Stormy Daniels hush money story, and they killed it with Rupert Murdoch saying, no, we want Donald Trump to win. We are not going to reveal the truth if it might hurt Donald Trump. So we also know that there's a revolving door between the administration and Fox News. Their executives go to work in the White House. Ex-employees go to work at Fox back and forth. And honestly, even before they get the jobs, they're acting as if they're auditioning for it. Nobody watches Jeanine Pirro and thinks that she is not trying to get a job in the Trump administration. Donald Trump clearly talks to Hannity on a daily basis. Hannity himself says this, repeats his show in tweets. They share a lawyer, which Hannity didn't disclose. So more improprieties and unethical behavior between some of their top figures and Donald Trump. Not too long ago, Bernie Goldberg, who used to be a frequent guest on the O'Reilly Factor, said that Fox News executives stopped them from criticizing high-profile Republican politicians like Donald Trump and Sarah Palin back in the day. They said they were okay at times with having liberals on who would criticize those people, but we were not going to have conservative infighting over those particular figures. So again, Tucker Carlson can say all he wants about we're free to say whatever we want. That is not the case from a person who is a paid contributor to Fox News. Little things like his son is dating one of their former hosts. Small thing, just figure I should mention it. They allowed Trump to come on month after month after year to spout the racist birther lie long after we knew that there was absolutely nothing to it except stark racism. They did that as a network because it benefited them. They pushed lies about the ACA's death panels, and now we've got the version where hamburgers and cows and planes are all going to be banned. They're doing that. They know that it's not true, but they have a mission. They have a goal. They pushed the conspiracy theory about Hillary Clinton or one of her surrogates killing Seth Rich long after the family was saying, please, for the love of God, stop lying about what happened to our son. They did that. So, look, we could go on and on and on. They have a mission. They would not be doing that debate to let the voters find out more about the candidates. They would be pushing an extremely partisan, ideological, radical narrative to try to derail the Democratic primary. Now, are they going to have general election debates? Almost certainly, yes, they're going to have that. But there is no reason that the Democratic Party should give them any say whatsoever what ends up happening in the Democratic primary. And neither Tom Perez or the DNC or anyone else should feel at all ashamed about making what is the most obvious decision in the world. Now, with that said, we are going to take a break. We come back more on the primary. Who is John Hickenlooper after this?
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Okay, so I've exaggerated a little bit recently about how little I know about some of the Democratic primary candidates in 2020, including John Hickenlooper. But really, I do think that he's one of the list that people do need to know a little bit better. And so we're going to delve into his record, how the primary might play out for him. And joining us to do that is federal politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, Sarah Kleiner. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you so much.
Good to have you here and to reveal Hickenlooper and how this whole thing might go for him. So first of all, for some who might not be familiar with him and what he brings to this primary, what are some of the important facts that they need to know about him in advance of it?
Sure. Okay. So John Hickenlooper was born outside Philadelphia. He eventually moved to Colorado for the oil and gas business. He had a degree in geology. He was laid off in the mid-1980s and started a brewery, and he was kind of on the forefront of that scene. Breweries are everywhere nowadays, but back then that wasn't the case. So he started a brewery in a part of Denver that was kind of run down and dilapidated. And then he and his business partners expanded, and they eventually grew to have 15 brew pubs and restaurants around the Midwest. So he got involved in politics. He ran for Denver mayor in 2003 and won. He ran for re-election in 2007 and got 87% of the vote there. Wow. In Denver. While he was mayor, they expanded pre-K to every four-year-old in Denver. He was persuaded to run for governor, and he did that in 2011 and won. And governor of Colorado. And then he ran for re-election in 2015, and he won that as well. He had, at the time, as a Democrat, he had a Republican legislature for most of his tenure as governor. So he touts his ability to work across the aisle and still pass progressive measures as something that voters should know about him. They passed some gun regulations, background checks, and a ban on high-capacity magazines while he was in office. One thing that some critics of John Hickenlooper point out is his relationship with the oil and gas industry, particularly when it comes to fracking. Fracking is bringing natural gas up out of the ground. It's hydraulic fracturing, and you pump chemicals down into the ground, and it brings natural gas up. And so environmentalists are particularly concerned about this particular aspect of his past.
So I'm curious. I read a recent article about him that speculated that everybody is thinking, you know who we need against Trump on the debate stage and in the campaign is someone who's going to punch him as hard as he punches them. But he has this reputation, Hickenlooper, of being like the nice guy politician. You say he's known for working across the aisle. He comes across as a very nice guy. Do you think that that might be an alternative way to deal with Trump, like having someone who clearly is a much better person in some way?
So Hickenlooper has said that, in fact, in his campaign launch video, he brought up the fact that he used to wear Coke bottle glasses and he had a funny last name and he's used to standing up to bullies. And so he's trying to paint himself as someone who can actually stand up to Trump. Now, he is not as acerbic as some candidates who say, for instance, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who call out Trump on Twitter. So he doesn't come across as forcefully as some of his rivals in this race.
So in addition to you brought up the past support for fracking, which I feel like is going to be a negative in this primary. I think justifiably so. He's also facing an inquiry with the Colorado Independent Ethics Commission on an accusation that he accepted trips and didn't disclose them as gifts being given to him. What do you make of that?
Sure. So apparently he took some trips while governor to Italy and some other trips and didn't disclose them. This is according to a Republican who filed a complaint against him. And Hickenlooper has basically dismissed this and said that it's politics. A Republican is targeting him. So we have to wait and see how that's going to shake out and how that might affect him down the road.
So I'm curious, you did all this research for your write-up, which our audience should definitely go look and learn much more about Hickenlooper. What do you see as the biggest challenge that he might face on the debate stage when being contrasted with what is likely to be well over a dozen other candidates?
So Hickenlooper is really starting from the starting line. And others are way out in front of him in terms of fundraising, in terms of name recognition. So he's got a long road to go when it comes to raising money. His Giddy Up PAC raised about $600,000 between September and December. And so he's really starting from behind. Candidates like Elizabeth Warren already have, you know, in the tens of millions of dollars stockpiled, ready to go to spend on advertising to get their names out there. And also Hickenlooper really, you know, is going to have a challenge when it comes to getting his name out there. He does have this knack for political ads that are quirky, that kind of play off of his quirky personality. He took a shower in a business suit once. And so he does have a way of maybe creating these viral ads. So that could be one thing that he uses to his advantage. But I would say definitely money and name recognition are going to be his biggest challenges.
Okay. Well, look, now I've got some homework. I'm going to have to look up some of these ads. So thank you for that. I get to see him shower soon. Sarah Kleiner, the Center for Public Integrity, thank you, as always, for joining the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
We're going to take a short break. We come back. Big hearing. Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security answering questions about the administration's family separation policy. And it does not go well for her. We'll break those down after this. Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security Kirstjen Nielsen is going to be remembered for presiding over the family separation policy of the Trump administration. And in her first hearing before the new Democrat-controlled House of Representatives, answering questions about that, not one of her strong suits. And so I want to show you some videos from Representative Lauren Underwood asking her about research showing how traumatic separation can be for young kids. And I want you to see in real time how Kirstjen Nielsen wilts under the pressure. So in this first one, was she aware of research showing that kids being separated would be traumatic?
The information that I was aware of at the time was that the trauma is part of the journey to come up to the border illegally.
Okay. So that's a clever little evasion. It becomes less clever in the context of using it to take away any responsibility of yourself for doing permanent damage to these kids. So, you're aware that the trip will be traumatic. Okay. That's true. The thing is, we can't control that necessarily. We can't stop that effect from happening. What we can do is make it so that when they enter our country, we don't compound the problem in whole new ways and make it far worse than it needs to be. That's how a serious person responds to that sort of concern. And I understand that she's part of the administration. She's going to have to defend the policy. But she doesn't have to try to be cute about it. She doesn't have to completely disregard any concern for these kids' continuing welfare. And that is what I saw there. And you're probably going to see more of it. So here is more on this line of questioning from Representative Underwood.
Were you aware that toxic stress can actually change a child's brain because it's still developing?
I wasn't familiar with the term.
Okay. Were you aware that the effects of these traumas are cumulative, that they get worse the longer the trauma goes on?
I'd like to clarify because we're missing a bigger point here, but yes, ma'am, I'm sorry. Respectfully, okay. Let me answer your questions.
Were you aware that the traumatic effects don't go away even if a child is reunited with their family?
I understand that they are, no.
Okay.
Yeah, so those are hard questions to answer. I get that. Nobody wants to have the reputation of presiding over permanent traumatic psychological damage to children. So what you could have done, Kirstjen Nielsen, is resign from the administration. You could have found out that this is going to be the policy. And although she tried to make evasions and other questions about whether she knew, her answers implied that she knew all too well that this is what was going to happen under Donald Trump and under the DHS, under her watch. She could have left. She could have done the moral thing. She could have done the ethical thing. She could have just done the pragmatic thing to defend her reputation. And she could have dwelled in the shadows for a couple of years and then returned to a think tank or Republican politics some other time. But you didn't want to do that. You wanted to be a part of this policy, Kirstjen Nielsen. And that is why this is going to be your reputation. This stain is not going to be washed away with a couple more years of blasé news. If God help us, if you stop separating the kids. We're not going to forget about this. And by the way, Representative Underwood, like I'm going to show one more video of her in just a second. She has a long line of questioning in this light. I have not seen her in a lot of these committee hearings, but her line of questioning was as strong as any of the other representatives that have been rightfully lauded over the past couple of years. She was not able to be deterred by Kirstjen Nielsen's attempts at evasion and circular logic and all of that. She stayed on message, and you can see how it's affecting the secretary in real time. She knows what she's being accused of because she knows what she did. And you can see, I guess she has more of a moral core than others in the Trump administration in that it seems to be affecting her. You can see how hurt she is to have to think about it. But I'm only going to give her that much credit, not much more, since she did do it after all. So one more in this same line of questioning.
Were you aware that family separation can lead to behavioral changes and learning delays for children?
Again, kids should be with their families.
So I will take that as a no. Were you aware that it increases a child's risk of heart disease, diabetes, and cancer?
I would ask all parents to go to ports of entry, not to separate their children and send them on the journey alone, and not to break U.S. law.
Okay, so she is back in the full-on Trump Defense Force mode. They shouldn't be separated. And if someone separates from their kids outside of the U.S., Kirstjen Nielsen can't change that. I can't change that. You can't change that. But what we can do is not do it for them once they come into this country. I know that. You know that. She knows that. Everybody knows that. Everybody knows what the effect of that policy would be. And let's not forget, that was not just the effect of the policy. That was the goal of the policy. They said in their planning, we know, we want to scare them off from coming into this country. And so we will be as cruel as we need to be to make sure that they change their behavior. It was not an unfortunate side effect. It was the stated mission of the policy. And that is what we've seen. And I'm sure you've seen the videos of kids being checked up on after several months after they'd been reunited. They're still being affected psychologically and emotionally by that experience, let alone the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds who will literally never see their families again. Those kids don't get talked about anymore, but they are very, very real. And we found out about that at the same time we were finding out that thousands more kids have been separated than we had initially been privy to. And Kirstjen Nielsen there every step of the way. Kirstjen Nielsen was also questioned by Congress on the particular housing that she provided for these kids. Many people have called them cages, but does she think that's a fair comparison to make?
Sir, they're not cages.
What are they?
Areas of the border facility that are carved out for the safety and protection of those who remain there while they're being processed.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that is a particularly interesting and Orwellian defense of it. We put them in cages not to keep them there, but to protect them. My follow-up would have been, can they leave? No? Sounds like a cage to me. But actually, there's better, Chris. So that was Representative Thompson. Representative Bonnie Watson Coleman had a great line of argumentation on how ridiculous it is to pretend that these are anything other than cages. Take a look at this.
What is a chain link fence enclosed into a chamber on a concrete floor represent to you? Is that a cage?
It's a detention space, ma'am, that you know has existed for decades.
Does it differ from the cages you put your dogs in when you let them stay outside? Is it different?
Yes.
In what sense?
It's larger. It has facilities. It provides room to sit, to stand, to lay down.
So did my dog's cage.
That is devastating. Jesus. And by the way, I don't know if you caught it. So before the final point from Representative Coleman, which was devastating enough, when Kristen Nielsen was answering, you could see just the slightest tinge of like, kind of like an ironic smile. Like she knew as she was answering that, every differentiation I'm providing between the cages we put the kids in and the cages we put our dogs in, I'm not actually providing a strong defense. And she knew that in the moment. Sometimes something can happen to you and it can stay in your mind for the rest of your life. It can be cited by people for the rest of your life. Lots of politicians have gaffes and they don't necessarily know at the time what's happening to them. But I think that she realized it. I think that her attempt to pretend that they treated these kids like anything other than animals, that's going to hurt her for the rest of her career. And I don't just mean in terms of public relations. This is the sort of thing that if you are a part of, if you willingly include yourself in this policy, like you have to live with yourself from that point on. And you can try to make up for it later on in life, but you caged children. You ruined families. You ruined them for all time. Even the ones who get back together, they're going to be affected by this, and all too many will never see each other again. And she knows what she did. And hopefully there will be people like Representative Coleman and others who will make sure that she never forgets it. By the way, sort of a side note, I know that like responsibility for crimes that are committed isn't a big thing in the modern era, but she lied multiple times under oath there. And you might recall Michael Cohen, like the Republicans attacking him constantly for being a felon, with the biggest felony that he committed that they keep referencing is that he lied to Congress. Well, I mean, you can go through those videos and there are any number of willful lies, in particular about whether she knew that there would be a policy of family separation on the Trump administration. So is there any reason that she shouldn't have the same sort of legal penalties as Michael Cohen? Well, no, except that we live in an absolutely terrible timeline where terrible people get away with terrible things. But there could be consequences for that. So finally, Secretary Nielsen is going to defend Donald Trump, and she will go to ridiculous lengths to do that. So Donald Trump is a guy that will lie constantly and obviously in a way that is very easy to prove, and he has done that on the number of apprehensions of people coming across the border. Now, Kristen Nielsen is not willing, she doesn't have the moral fiber to actually stand up for the truth, which will become very clear in this video.
Apologize, I don't know the full context of that. What I can tell you is we have encountered more family units per month than ever in history.
What the president said, is it accurate or not?
I just don't know the context of his statement, sir. If he was talking about family units in a particular sector,
I'm talking about the number. We went from 1.6 million in 2000 apprehensions and 400,000 in 2018. The president said that there were never so many apprehensions at the border in our history up until now. Is that accurate?
Again, we've had monumental high numbers in some areas of the border.
Jim, I'm just trying to get a yes or no.
I just don't know the context of his statement.
Okay, so the questioner there did a great job. I would have added one more thing. You might have seen in that video, maybe you didn't notice it was in the foreground. So in front of her, she had a little placard with her name. And it said, it was Honorable Kristen Nielsen. I think you can take a Sharpie to the first part of that at this point. If you're asked the question, which is bigger, more than a million or 400,000, and you can't answer that, I mean, you've sold your soul. And like lots of people in history have been said to have sold their soul to the devil. He's persuasive and charming. You sold it to Donald Trump. That's worse in my view. It is not the case that more apprehensions have happened over the past year than in all years since. It is an obvious, verifiable fact. She kept saying, I don't know the context. The context is that he does not care whether things are true or false. Kirstjen Nielsen knows that as well as any of us know that. And the thing is, it's bad enough if the president doesn't care if the information he's imparting to the American people is true or false. It's worse when he is able to convince all of the other high-ranking officials in his administration to sign on to his ongoing campaign against the truth. And she is a very, she is a reliable lieutenant in that fight for Donald Trump. Now we're going to take a break. We come back. A push to decriminalize sex work in New York. Does it have a chance of passing? And is it possible that we could see this start to spread across the country after this? Could we finally be seeing the destigmatizing and decriminalizing of sex work in America? Joining us now to help break down some recent developments is a reporter for The Intercept, Natasha Leonard. Natasha, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here. And so I want to start by talking about recent bills in New York, especially in New York, but also California, that might decriminalize in various ways sex work. Let's talk about those. How have they been received? What is the chance of them passing? What's your take?
Well, I think the introduction, and particularly of the New York bill, which is a bill in both for the New York Congress and Senate, that are asking for there to be full decriminalization. And I think that's a really important thing for people to understand. This bill is saying that were it to be passed, any consensual exchange for sex would be decriminalized, as in it would be a legal exchange. This would remove sex work from the realms of policing, from the realms of the criminal justice system that does so much to police and stigmatize, punish, and incarcerate sex workers who are often some of the most vulnerable minorities. Certainly, many, many sex workers are Black trans women who are also some of the most policed and persecuted under current sex crime criminalization, sex work criminalization, excuse me. So this is a big deal to have state senators and major organizations pushing for full decriminalization as opposed to some of the more limited models that individuals like Senator Kamala Harris are pushing for, which are not, in fact, decriminalization. They rather go towards criminalization of the purchase of sex, which still puts sex workers in vulnerable positions. So we're seeing a big shift to even have these bills on the table. How quickly we could see them pass, it's hard to know, but it doesn't necessarily need to be a long way off, especially in jurisdictions like New York, where Democrats are now in charge of the Senate.
So you've been talking about how the push from many of the activist groups who are promoting bills like this is for full decriminalization.
Yes.
I mean, you contrast it with a more limited version, which we see in some countries, actually. So when we don't reach full decriminalization, when the idea is that the person purchasing it is still considered to have committed a criminal act, why is it that that still results in some really bad and unjust situations for the women involved in this?
Right. So this is known as the Nordic model because it is the model in place in many Scandinavian countries. And what it does is it pushes sex work as an industry underground. So even the claim that the sex worker themselves is not to be criminalized, anyone who's interested in engaging in the sex industry and buying sex must do so through a black or gray market. This means that workers have less access to workers' rights discourse, to going forward to complain about exploitation, to complain about mistreatment by managers, because then they're involving the criminal justice system. And what we've seen in Scandinavian countries where this is the case is the policing of individuals who are immigrants without paperwork. They're still very much watched So even if it's only a John or a client who is being criminalized, the sex worker themselves is often swept up into mm-hmm. a policed and criminal justice system. And this has played out very badly in terms of people losing their rights to the custody of their children and deportations. If this is an industry that can be decriminalized, it removes vulnerable people from proximity to a punitive carceral system. And that is the safest way in which sex workers can live and seek more robust rights and safeties. It's just an empirical fact that sex workers working in decriminalized zones are able to work more safely, work together, be in the open, and not risk further violence as yeah. well as exploitation from police and the criminal justice system.
So you mentioned Kamala Harris and her position on this. I'm curious, we know that there are politicians in New York who are pushing for full decriminalization. In the primary, are there any declared candidates out of the 37 or so that we have that are actually supportive of full federal decriminalization of sex work?
I have not heard that in so many terms from a single candidate. I think given that the attention that this is getting on a state level and that we are seeing a sea change around this discourse, a long overdue one that sex workers' rights advocates and people from within the industry have been ferociously fighting for decades and decades, given that we've seen this sea change shift in the mainstream discourse, I am curious what will happen and whether this will be an issue put before the presidential candidates. I'm certainly nervous that the fulcrum of discourse will fall around calling what Senator Harris put forward decriminalization when, as I mentioned, it in fact would not be. But it would be definitely a promising step forward to talk about full decriminalization and how that is a workers' rights and feminist rights issue.
That's what's so interesting, because it clearly is a case where this is a group of workers who are incredibly stigmatized, have virtually no rights, could end up in jail and all of that. And you would think that people would be willing to stand up for it, especially when there are politicians who are not supportive of workers' rights. There's big money on the opposite side of the issue. But if there is in this case, I'm not seeing it. And so the lack of willingness of many politicians in the vast majority of cases at the state level, at the federal level, to not support this. Is this just American Puritanism? The idea that this is just a group that, I mean, ideologically, yeah, we support them, but I don't want to be tied in with this group of people?
I think it's an intersection of a number of things that are not only unique to America. The stigmatization and the social pariah, treating sex workers as social pariahs and threats to the family form and the nation's body politic. These are age old and deeply problematic. And also in a contemporary setting, all kinds of persecutions and abuses seep through, be it racism, anti-trans sentiment, general police treatment of sexual violence, the use, as we see all too often under this administration, but also those that preceded it, the use of claims of trafficking in order to police and deport immigrants. So sex workers' rights find themselves at the intersection of so many struggles that have meant a lot of mainstream politicians have been too wary to get behind it. But really, if we're going to be taking seriously workers' rights, if we're going to take seriously immigrant rights, trans rights, and women's rights, it would be a vast moral and political failure to leave sex workers out of this equation, let alone not to center them in these struggles.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. Natasha Leonard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. We come back. Some new polling in the Democratic primary, both opportunities and challenges for a number of candidates becoming more clear as we get into this thing. We'll break those down after this. I'm going to acknowledge right off the bat that it's kind of early to be getting into polling data, but it's going to define our lives politically for a long time, the Democratic primary, over the course of the next year or so. So we've got some interesting data coming out of a morning consult poll that details for some candidates challenges that are definitely going to come for them, advantages for others, and opportunities depending on who actually ends up running. as the people have already declared, some who seem like they're going to. And if they drop out, where will their voters go? All of this fascinating to me, so let's break down some of this. Understanding, by the way, that Sherrod Brown is not going to be running. He announced that earlier today. That's not really going to change our analysis, though, for reasons that might have gotten into why he didn't end up running. So let's talk, first of all, Morning Consult poll. Who's leading right now? Again, we're like 1,000 days before the first primary, but as of right now, Joe Biden, amongst Democratic primary voters as a whole, does have a lead of 4 points over Bernie Sanders, then dropping down from 27% for Bernie Sanders to Kamala Harris is in third, and it starts to drop pretty fast after that. I've included the top six because there are far more than six, but the vast, vast majority of them in these polls are rating at 2% or 1% or even 0% for some of the declared candidates. So again, super early, but understand that. What's interesting is that if you go beyond this, and not just the Democratic primary voters, but those who are going to be voting in early primaries, let's go to that. And you'll see that the top two actually have a bigger advantage there. So Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders take up a bigger share of the early voters than they do of primary voters as a whole. The overall ranking is still similar. Kamala Harris is still in third. You see a little bit of shuffling with Beto O'Rourke, Elizabeth Warren, and all of that, and Cory Booker rounds it out. So regardless of whether it's the country as a whole or the early states, that's basically the ranking. But as of right now, big leads for Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. And remember, Joe Biden still hasn't declared. I do think that he's going to run. I think that the process of campaigning is going to hurt him quite a bit. But he's not even running right now. So I think that is absolutely fascinating. So now the obvious response to this is, well, of course Biden and Bernie are doing the best. They're the ones with the best name recognition, which is true. But there's a little bit of nuance there as well. So let's bring up, do you have a favorable impression, unfavorable? Have you heard of this candidate for all of them? And you'll see there that Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, very favorable overall. Bernie has a slightly higher unfavorability rating. Elizabeth Warren at 19% unfavorable. I have a feeling that's not policy-based for Elizabeth Warren. But you see there that what you want to look at is the number in the white. So only like 3% of voters don't know who Joe Biden is. It's sort of similar for Bernie Sanders. When you get to Elizabeth Warren, 11% don't know her. 21% don't know Kamala Harris. So for Kamala Harris, Beto O'Rourke, and Cory Booker, if you want to make the case that there's still a lot of people who don't know who they are, they could rise rapidly once they find out who they are. That is entirely possible. But let's acknowledge this is not for them the same as, say, Bernie Sanders in May of 2015, where literally five people outside of Vermont knew who he is. These are all national figures like Cory Booker, Beto O'Rourke, Kamala Harris. They have generally been operating inside of the state that they work in, but they have gotten a lot of news coverage, and that's why those unknown numbers aren't higher. Democratic voters generally do know who these people are. That doesn't mean that there's not a lot of time for them to change their minds, and 20% is not nothing, let alone 30 or more. But bear that in mind. Now, in terms of those two front runners, so breaking down the demographics a little bit more, very interesting. Again, caveat, we're super early in. But right now, Bernie Sanders' support amongst black voters at 28% puts him in second place among that demographic behind Biden, who is at 32%. So 32% for Biden, 28% for Bernie. Bernie Sanders trails Biden 31-25 amongst white voters, which means that as of right now, at least, Bernie Sanders is capturing a higher share of the African-American vote than he is the white vote right now. Although Biden does have the advantage in both of those categories as of right now. Now, breaking it down in terms of income, so the demographic Sanders is least popular in at 19% and 17% are Democrats who make more than $100,000 per year and Democrats who have postgraduate degrees, bearing in mind that there is a significant overlap between those two. So there are racial differences in vote choice in the primary, certainly, but there's also income and education differences. And Bernie Sanders tends to do best amongst those who make the least amount of money, which is perhaps not surprising considering his platform and his rhetoric and all of that. One interesting fact in terms of ideological preference broken down by race, I thought this was fascinating. So in February, there was a Harvard-Harris poll that found that 56% of black voters preferred a, quote, mostly socialist economic system against 44% who want a, quote, mostly capitalist one. So look, we've seen similar sorts of numbers like that, preferring socialism over capitalism amongst young voters and things like that. These polls don't tend to get talked about for some reason, but that's a pretty dominating lead. And I don't know why that's not a part of the narrative about this. Certainly could play into preference once we get into the primaries. Now, very important is we're starting with a lot of candidates this time around. But we're not going to end with a lot of candidates. People are going to be dropping off in the, after the first and second debates. So if they start to drop off, who do we think might actually benefit from that? Well, there is data on that. Second and third choice amongst voters is something that people have been polling. So in that Morning Consult poll, let's take a look at this. I know it's a lot of numbers. Let's start. Joe Biden, he is the first choice of 31% of potential voters, but he's not even a declared candidate. If he doesn't run, or if he ends up dropping out, where will his voters go? Weirdly, 28% will go to Bernie Sanders. Harris and Warren come after that. Same thing for Sanders. So interesting. A lot of people, his people go to Biden. So look, we're going to return to that fascinating phenomenon. Anyway, thank you for joining us on the show today. Lots more to get to as we close out the week tomorrow. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.